Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Support for The Common comes from Davis Malm. Their tax attorneys take the time to understand your unique goals and find the most cost-effective ways to accomplish them, distilling complex tax laws down to clear choices so you can make the best decisions. DavisMalm.com, DavisMalm.com.
Hey, it's Daryl C. Murphy, and I just want to talk to you real quick. The Common is produced at WBUR in Boston. We're public media. We don't have paywalls, which means we don't ask you to pay to see our work. We say, here's some powerful stories for free. And then, if some of those stories you read or listen to are important to you and you talk about it with your friends and family, and you even see the world a little differently, then we ask you to support it. Because we want to continue making work that is meaningful to you. And right now, I want to let you know what's happening at WBUR. Our radio shows, our podcasts are getting some of the biggest audiences we've ever had. Our journalism is winning awards, reaching new and more diverse audiences. And you are a big part of that. Our journalism has never been stronger, but the business has never been harder. We've had a big loss of sponsorship dollars, like a lot of media companies have in recent years. But one thing we've always been pretty good at is getting support from our listeners to make the things they love. So we're asking right now, in a crucial moment for WBUR, can you help us get through this by joining other listeners in supporting WBUR? We need your help to keep making the podcast you're listening to right now, along with everything else that comes from WBUR. Your help would mean a lot to me and to all of my colleagues. So please, head to our website, WBUR.org. Thanks.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger, you are back again.
Hi, Daryl. How are you today?
I'm all right. Thank you for joining us for a second time this week.
So glad to be here.
Yeah, we had to have you on because you did a story about a group of medical professionals who were volunteering at the finish line on the day of the Boston Marathon bombings 10 years ago. And out of that tragedy, they've grown close to each other since that day. So to start us off, Martha, tell us about a few of the people you spoke to and what they told you about what happened that day.
I spoke to several athletic trainers, Daryl. They were stationed right at the finish line. They watch runners coming across to be sure that they catch everybody who might need some medical attention. When they heard the first bombing, they thought it might have been a transformer that had blown, but they saw the smoke and they headed into that chaos of screaming, shouting, police officers drawing their weapons. They climbed over tangled metal barricades and fences into the chaos of body limbs and pools of blood and torn clothing and started performing whatever medical assistance they could, pulling off their belts to tie around legs to stop bleeding. That was the people outside the tent. Then I spoke to Lynn Landry, who's a nurse inside the tent, Sarah Menendez, Chris Troyanos, people who were volunteering that day. They could see the chaos through there's an opening in the tent, and they could see the chaos of people running away from the bombings. They could hear, obviously, what was going on, but they were also laser-focused on the runners in front of them who were cramping or having nausea or, you know, who had passed out. So it was a lot to take in all at once and a very, really traumatic experience.
That sounds terrible, but they went back to volunteering eventually, right? Like, how long did it take for them to go back to doing that?
Well, Daryl, let me say also, like, they actually stayed there in the tent. There are these big screen TVs set up in the tent so they can monitor the race. That coverage on the TVs quickly switched to coverage of the bombings. So they were essentially watching coverage of the place where they were working, trying to get IV lines into people who were being brought in off the streets, trying to continue to heal runners, trying to decide who's most serious and needs to go to the hospital right away versus can stay in the tent for a while. They kept doing that work while police were setting off, you know, trying to detonate other possible explosions there. They could hear all of that happening around them. And they stayed there in those tents until police said, you got to leave. You know, we got to sweep this whole area. You got to leave. They went to a second medical tent, which is a little further down the course, and kept doing the same work until, again, police said, you got to leave. So these people were dedicated to the point where, you know, it's hard to imagine them not coming back. And in fact, they did. The next race, they were back. They were there. And they have been ever since.
Okay. So I guess they just felt like if they didn't volunteer, somehow they would be defeated. Is that it? Like they wanted to show their strength and resilience.
So there's a couple of things here, Daryl. I think many of them felt like the people they had gone through that experience with became some of the few people who could understand that experience. And because it was so consuming for their lives, so defining for their lives, they wanted to continue being with those people doing that work. So they actually volunteered for even more races there in 2013, in addition to coming back in 2014 and the many years after. They also felt completely committed to the runners, to the people who they were supporting by volunteering as medical professionals. They wanted to be sure that the race could go on. You know, there was that huge Boston Strong fervor, and they felt very caught up in that, very part of that, you know. As Chris Troiano says, they wanted to be able to say F you to the terrorists. And the way they could do that was by coming back strong as medical volunteers.
So they're kind of a family at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are, you know, as many as 1,800 medical volunteers up and down the course of the Boston Marathon. There are a lot of people who come out to volunteer. Mm-hmm. But this core group of 12 to 15 or so people have become kind of the backbone of the medical operations. They do a lot of setting up the tents. They, you know, put the little flags on the wheelchairs, make sure everything is in place. They run the IV lines and the hoses and all kinds of other prep to be sure that the race is ready to go. And not just at the Boston Marathon, but at a dozen or so events around the country every year. They travel as volunteers, as a family, together to do this work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How many races do they go to each year?
About a dozen. Yeah, it varies a little bit from year to year, but it's everything from another couple of walks and races in Boston to they do one on the Cape, they do the one on the coast of Maine, sometimes they go out to California. It varies, but it's a well-oiled machine amongst a group of people who are completely devoted to each other. Here's Chris Troianos, he's the medical coordinator, explaining how the group works.
Every one of these people, medical or not, I mean, I trust them with my life. I mean, I know that they're going to do what we need, and I never question it.
And when he says never question it, Daryl, he means in any situation, you know, with climate change, people are running in hotter and hotter temperatures. So this past summer and even into the fall, this race family saw more heat stroke and more exhaustion than they had ever seen before in the races where they volunteered. They had one guy whose core temperature got up to 108 degrees. I mean, that's hot enough to melt organs. And everybody survives because this team knows so well how to work together and what to do.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Martha.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. What's the deal with the underwear? I hear there's there's something about matching underwear.
Yeah, there is. So after the 2013 bombings, in one of the counseling sessions, Lynn Landry and a few other nurses went out to lunch. And one of the nurses had brought a package of gifts for everyone. And that package of gifts included red underwear. I don't know why she bought the red underwear, but I do know that the reaction to it was like delight. I mean, they needed a laugh. It was a very dark time, and red underwear made everybody smile. And Lynn Landry decided they would be her lucky red underwear. So she wore them to a few races, and everything went fine, and she decided, yeah, they're working. Everybody should wear red underwear. And now they do. They wear them to all of the races that they volunteer at, men and women, and they wear them to other official race family events like birthday parties or Christmas gatherings or any other dinner. It's a little joke to kind of look around the room and say, you got on your reds? And see people nod.
Will this family be at the Boston Marathon on Monday?
Oh, yes. Not only on Monday, Daryl. Many of them will be in hotel rooms as of Thursday or Friday night in Boston because they set up for all of the events that happen over the course of the weekend. They assist with the 5K on Saturday. They're there at the expo to help with CPR training. It's a big commitment, not just this weekend, but on many. But for sure, they will all be there this Monday. Lynn Landry and her husband, they quarantined leading up to the race. Because last year they got COVID and had to miss, and they were so disappointed, so frustrated, that they decided this year they were not going to take any chances. So they have been isolating to be sure that they are safe and healthy and ready for this weekend.
I understand for many of the volunteers, it was their first time talking about their experience. What did you take away from this story?
I took away what the group reflects, which is the power of the relationships that they've built, the trust that they rely on, the work that they can continue to do despite some ongoing security and other threats, is the best way that they found to say, as they say it, F you to the terrorists. They found a way to fight back against the despair and the horror of that day. They found a way to fight back with love. They found a way to fight back by saying, we're going to invest in people as opposed to withdrawing. We're going to be sure that we can form bonds that are stronger than those the terrorists tried to dismantle on April 15th, 2013. Mm. And here's Emma Nelson, after a lot of sharing, kind of summing up what it means to be a part of this group to her.
We have to be there. We have to be there for each other. So it's difficult to put into words exactly what it means, but it means everything at the same time.
So I think Emma, who's an orthopedic therapist, and many other people in the group would say that what they've formed, what they have built together in terms of their relationships, in terms of the work they do, is a way to respond to the defeat and the really existential crisis that many people felt after the bombings. And by building these bonds of trust, by investing so much in each other and in these races that they work to make sure are safe and successful for everyone, they've defeated that existential feeling that they came out of the marathon with.
With that said, Martha, thank you so much for coming back to the Common a second time within the week. We really appreciate it. And yeah, thank you for bringing us the story.
Thank you so much for your interest, Daryl. Really appreciate you having me.
That's WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Common. If you have any thoughts on this episode, give us a shout on Instagram at WBURTheCommon. You can also send us an email at thecommon@wbur.org. And now, it is that time for me to let you know that The Common is produced by Caitlin Harrop and Franny Monahan, with help this week from Nora Sachs and Wilder Fleming. It's mixed by Emily Jankowski, Matt Reed, and Paul Vikas, and it's edited by Ben Brock Johnson. And from the newsroom of WBUR, I'm your host, Daryl C. Murphy. I'll talk to you soon.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people, who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.